Okay, let's get started. I want to thank Disney for coming. I really appreciate it. Next speaker, Jerry Zullo, Senior Executive Vice President and CFO of Disney Company. He's traveled to get here. I really appreciate you being here, Jay. Look forward to talking to you. And the ground rules, again, would be we have cards for Q&A. Pass them to the middle, about 20 minutes to go. We'll pick them up. I'll ask them for you. So please send your cards up a little bit later. So thanks so much. Okay. Jay, thank you, and thank you, Lowell.
You're welcome, Michael. Happy to be here.
So a while back, we started to hear the phrase, the Disney difference, used by the company to describe the uniqueness of your assets and your strategies. Now I'd say the Disney difference can be extended to your approach to building businesses and capital usage. Let's use this time together to learn more about the impact of those allocation decisions. I want to start with Media Networks, which is a business that contributes 60% of your operating income. You spent the past few years building a moat, in words, acquiring key sports rights and adding new applications around ESPN. Are you worried that either the competition by new entrants or changing regulatory environment or slowing pay TV growth will ultimately hurt the profitability of this great franchise?
Wow, we can probably do the whole 45 minutes on that whole those questions. But first of all, let me tell you that I appreciate your talking about the Disney difference. It is something that we talk about a lot. And I want to spend a couple of minutes talking about that. But before I get into that, I want to get something out of the way that is specific about Q3, and it kind of refers back to the earnings call that we did a couple of weeks ago, where I talked about some comparability items, and they were a little bit complicated. So I think it's worth repeating and maybe giving some clarification to the couple of items, because when we look across the estimates out there on the street, I don't think that maybe either I wasn't clear or they weren't properly reflected. First of all, I want to start with the studio. So obviously we are thrilled with the outcome of Iron Man 3. It is well on its way to doing $1.2 billion. That's what we think it'll wind up in box office, which, you know, normally everybody would say that's terrific. But remember, a year ago in Q3, just about in the same timing in terms of release, we released Avengers. And Avengers, third largest box office movie in history, did $1.5 billion in the box office. I also talked very explicitly about the fact that we will be marketing a film we are very, very excited about, Lone Ranger. All of a big portion of the marketing of that film will fall in Q3. But the release on July 3rd is a Q4 event. Right. So we'll be having that marketing out there. And the combined impact of those two things is going to be about $150 million decrease in OI for the studio in Q3 compared to prior year. So I just wanted to be, I talked about all of that on the call, but I just want to be a little more explicit. Okay. On the Media Network side, I'm just going to repeat that ESPN is going to recognize $73 million less in net deferred revenue in the quarter. Has to do with the covenants and timing of our different deals. That is a pure timing effect. And lastly, on the parks, I mentioned these things, but again, I want to be a little more explicit. In terms of the Easter holiday, which fell in the previous year in Q3. It is 1 week less of the Easter holiday will be in Q3. And also, we're now lapping a full year of the Disney Fantasy. It was sailing for the full quarter last year and this year. And the combined effect of those things is about $65 billion on the park's numbers. Yeah. So I just want to get that out of the way. I know you want to talk about loftier things, right, but I wanted to get those items out there and be sure that we were as clear as we could be about those items. So, talking about the Disney difference and our investment strategy, I think our strategy has been very consistent. And, you know, one of the things I love about working at Disney with the management team, with Bob, is that we don't invest around business cycles. We have an investment strategy. I think it's clear. We create and buy outstanding IP that we think has deep and long legs. We have a big ecosystem under which we can capitalize on that, and it creates, we think, a very different kind of company compared to those that we're generally compared to. And I will say that if you take an example, so let's say both happen to come through acquisitions, but you know, Pixar is now so long ago as an acquisition, it's kind of a part of the corpus of the company. But if you take the Cars franchise, of course, you know, the films have done outstandingly well. We don't have to talk too much about the impact that's had on our consumer products business. Obviously, it plays right into a long-term play pattern with boys and die-cast cars, and giving them sort of names, faces, and personalities has obviously, you know, been a huge boon to our consumer products business. But then you can't forget that a lot of the success of Disney's California Adventure and the relaunch there was really on the back of that great franchise. You know, Cars was the tentpole behind the relaunch of Disney's California Adventure, and it's just blown out. So you know, we look at franchises in those very powerful ways, how they can, you know, affect the rest of the company. If you look at Marvel and the Avengers, you know, here's a film again that in its own right, I mentioned already, did $1.5 billion in worldwide box office, but at the same time, it's had kind of a lifting, compounding effect, and you have to see the result of Iron Man 3 and what that's done in the box office, which is, you know, more than the previous two films combined, as in some way having been affected by the success of that franchise that we built around Avengers. Obviously, that reflects itself in consumer products. We've now announced that in September, a show called S.H.I.E.L.D. Is going to be released by ABC. We were talking outside. That was the other show that there was. Right. I told you there was so much buzz about. There's just an enormous amount of buzz around this franchise. And this is, when it's working at its best, this is how we like to allocate our capital, whether it's an internally developed franchise or brand or concept that we do that with, or whether it's through acquisition. We really like to think about the allocation of our capital across that kind of strategy. So coming back to Media Networks, you mentioned ESPN and this sense of the moat. And of course, when we talk about the moat, when we talk about capital allocation there, you know, largely we're talking about the acquisition of the right portfolio of sports rights. Right. And we feel, I got to say that, you know, ESPN is one of, if not the most predictable business for us in terms of its consistency, in terms of our confidence in what it can deliver to the company. And, you know, that's not because, okay, it is the number one sports brand. It's got 33 years of history. And it's not just because of that and because, you know, sports fans tell us over and over. It has to do with the actual structure of how we've invested. Very long-term sports rights deals. We pretty much know what our hand is going to be there for 8 to 15 years, depending on the league, the conference, the sport. But also, you know, 70% of our affiliate deals done with a similar time frame, 8 to 10 years. So we really do know in large. Of course, you know, there's the advertising portion, which is, you know, a little 30% plus of the revenue. But a lot of where we are in that business is pretty well secured and pretty well locked in our mind. And when we look at the competitive environment there, and, you know, we always get asked about Fox One and other competitors. Look, what we think is that there may well be a very fierce battle for a distant number two in that business. People are going to spend a lot of money. They're going to step up to bid on a lot of rights, and they're going to wind up a distant number two. So we feel pretty confident about our hand there. We feel very very good about the business. Let me be clear. We're not complacent. We look at everything that comes up. You've seen some recent deals that we've done in the tennis arena, and we continue to look at things that around the edges or in the main, you know, continue to give us that hand that allows me to speak with the confidence I'm speaking right about this morning. And in terms of the use of multi-platform, in terms of you know, having a broad array to continue to be the most popular brand for advertisers, the most popular brand for fans. We're not complacent about that. We constantly relaunch. You've heard about our Digital Center 2 up in Bristol, under which, you know, our studio shows are going to have, you know, a completely new an exciting look and feel. We're not sitting back and resting on our laurels, but we do feel incredibly secure and confident about our position.
How about the side of the question? One thing you can't control is the regulatory environment. So how do you assess the regulatory environment? Is any changes coming potentially?
Well, of course, from time to time, and you know, behind your question of the regulatory environment is this whole question of a la carte that, you know, from time to time goes up. Look, I don't think there has been any serious, thoughtful analysis that suggests that an a la carte world is actually better for consumers. You know, we have a strong belief that in an a la carte world, consumers will wind up paying more for less available content on television. And that if you look at the extended basic content and the quality of the production that goes into it, not only sports production and the viewing of sports, but you know all the other production values that have shown up on cable networks, it's still what we think is a wonderful value. If you look at ESPN subscribers over the last 2 years, you know there's not been a net change in the subscribers to ESPN. So we feel like, yeah, from time to time there's going to be some rabble-rousing about, you know, this concept of, you know, and it always kind of ends up being focused on sports. We still believe that that the value's there for consumers and that they'll continue to rational thinking will prevail in that belief system.
Okay, so let's talk a bit about, you mentioned before, a key component of the rights packages lately have been multi-channel rights. How has monetization of those rights turned out? First, in terms of affiliate dollars, affiliate fee dollars, now that you're done 70% of your deals. So how does that get constructed in the affiliate fee conversation?
Well, you know, we've been talking about this idea that ESPN had, you know, some time ago called best available screen for fans. I mean, we certainly know that, you know, over 99% or nearly 99% of sports is watched live. That sports fans want access wherever they are on whatever device they have near them, around them, or can look over somebody's shoulder at. And we've always sought to have a very broad multi-platform offering, and we continue to enhance that. When the tablet technology and the diffusion technology came out such that we could produce something like Watch ESPN, which is now, you know, in 55 million, there are 55 million households who have availability to watch ESPN. And when we talk about a big complex deal like our deal with Comcast, and say there are 70 services that were sold to Comcast, obviously we don't have that many channels. So a lot of those are different means of distribution of the same content, and so we've gotten that out there. I think it's well known, it's well accepted, and of course it was reflected in the deals. You know, we said all along that this notion of making television programming available to consumers was a value, that we were going to get remunerated for that, and we waited longer than others to get out there with it until there was a monetization model that could work. And when our affiliate deals came up for renewal, obviously it was something that the affiliates were very eager to have and paid for in the new deals that we did. But we also have the opportunity to stream advertising right to those things and separate streams of advertising that are addressable. Now, there's a bit of an issue with measurement today. There isn't really third-party measurement on the tablet, on Watch ESPN. By the way, we've done this for Watch Disney Channel and Watch ABC, as was announced a couple of weeks ago at the upfront. But we know, since these are addressable mobile units and we know exactly what we're setting, we have the data and advertisers are paying right for the ability to get those ads in front of consumers. We're hopeful that down the road there'll be, you know, the typical third-party calculation and recognition, and it will impact ratings. Today it doesn't impact ratings. We do believe that the tablet watching is mostly incremental and isn't hurting our ratings, but nor are we getting credit, you know, in the ratings for the viewing on the tablets. But we do have a means by which we can sell that and tell advertisers what they're getting.
Can you give us any update on what type of usage you're seeing on Watch ESPN? Anything you could share on minutes a day or hours? Like, you know, how many
We don't have that detail. As I said, I think we're at the point where we pretty much believe that it's incremental, but I can't give you the details. I'm sure our TV people have some sense of it, but not for public distribution.
Okay, and then I mentioned third-party measurement. What's the timeline from where you stand for third-party measurement to kick in? Is there anything that you're looking at as saying?
Well, there's a couple of pilot programs out there that we're looking at with Nielsen. Others are also working on it. We're hopeful that it'll be sooner rather than later, but I don't have any good fix on when that'll be literally out there like we have for other folks.
Okay, I wanted to give you a chance to comment publicly about that. There was a report in the journal that perhaps ESPN would subsidize mobile usage. I think you guys said that's unlikely, so you want to say that?
Yeah, it's extremely unlikely, and there's nothing to announce, and there's nothing imminent that will be announced, and I'm just not saying today. Look, we have a constant dialogue with our distributors. We're in close partnership with them across many things. There are many ideas that are batted back and forth between us and them. This was probably one of them. I don't think you should spend another minute thinking about it.
Hey, done. Okay, so let me take this question. How do you assess, so when you look at the acquisitions of sports programming rights, how do you assess the return these program decisions will be? So how do you figure out what to buy? And would you walk away from any rights auctions or passing rights that you don't truly need and you have in the past? So how does that work into your thinking?
Well, I think the easiest way to describe how we look at this is really we look at it as, additions and subtractions to a portfolio. We look, it's very hard when you're talking about, as I mentioned, nearly 70% of your revenue coming from affiliate revenue that isn't really dependent on whether you get the rights to the U.S. Open tennis tournament or not, as to what the pure economics of any specific decision might be. But we do look at, as I said, we have a good fix on what our affiliate fees are going to look like down the road. We have a good fix on what we can invest in totality around programming. And then we make assessments as to the power of each different property that comes up and how it will enhance our hand and enhance our portfolio, et cetera, both from, first and foremost from a fan perspective, secondly from a competitive perspective, thirdly, from an advertising appeal perspective, and we really kind of look at it that way. Look, we're going to show up for everything. To repeat what I said, we are not complacent about the hand we have. We will show up for everything, but understand, and there's been many examples now, that there are things that just get bid up to the point where we certainly can't see a return on it, and sometimes question how anybody could see a return on the kinds of numbers. If you look at the NCAA Final Four, who wouldn't want that property in the sports business? But at some point, I know who wouldn't. Somebody who's not willing to pay what it went for.
Right.
The Olympics, they're hockey. I mean, there are things that we've looked at, we've looked hard, we'd love to have, but we know that within the budget we know we can spend in totality and what we've got already, they'll break the budget and they won't incrementally add enough to pay back. So it's complex, but it's not, unfortunately, as arithmetic as maybe you'd like to hear me say.
So let me turn to some arithmetic answers.
Okay, so
we always look at the single biggest revenue driver. I don't know why, affiliate fees. It seems to be an important part of the Disney statement.
Yeah, we look at it, too.
Yeah, exactly. And the most recent quarter, we saw underlying affiliate fee growth close to 10%, excluding all the deferrals.
Yeah.
So given this was the first quarter of many new deals kicking in, can you help us think about affiliate fee growth over the next couple of years?
Sure. I said back on our call that we were looking at, for the rest of this year, I think you asked the question, we were looking at affiliate revenue growth, between the high single digits and low double digits for the rest of the year. And, I don't really like giving a range like that, but the truth is that in that range, there's a couple of unknowns. There's, what's going to happen with subscribers, and there are the pending deals that re-ups that are still out there and not knowing exactly when they are going to fall. I can tell you now that it's very unlikely that a new deal is going to happen in the third quarter, so we're probably going to end up in the low end of that range that I gave on the call for Q3. But in terms of, looking out beyond that, I don't want to be too predictive, but you know, as I've said, we are pretty happy with what we already know from the 70% of deals we have done, and what we know the underlying sports rights costs will be over the period.
Yeah, well, just give you a point of clarification. How do you feel? Is there a philosophy about new deals with big first-year step-ups dropping down, which was the previous regime's deals, versus a more consistent level of price increase over the life of the
deal? Well, I don't want to get, you know, every deal is different. B, I don't want to get into details about any of the deals. But, again, you know, when we say, oh, you know, what did you re-up ESPN for? So we think about it, you know, ESPN won, but there's the Deuce, there's the other channels. They all are in different, and then, you know, when you think of our, the entirety of our cable offering, right, the Disney Channel, Disney Junior, XD, ABC Family, they are all at different points of their life cycle. And, you know, some have history where they were launched at a rate that we thought was actually below their value and below market, and you step those up. So there's a lot that goes into what the 8 or 10 years of affiliate fees look like. And I don't want to kind of give you a one-size-fits-all that, hey, our strategy is to raise it and have it go flat. It's not quite that simple.
Okay. Now, going back to something you said about your visibility on this business, cable networks, Bob, on a call last year, stated the long-term margins. It was interesting that you guys, first time I've heard this on that for a while, was long-term margins are going to expand at cable networks over the life of the deals you're doing. But given the step-up in sports rights since that point in time, and the deals that you now have done, do you still believe that that vision Bob had of a long-term margin expansion within the KLNR group is sustainable?
Well, look, first of all, we don't give guidance on margins, and there's a reason for that. We don't run our business on margins. Right. Knowing the lumpiness that goes into the running of our cable networks, you know, new deals and all the stuff we've been talking about, we don't tend to look at quarter-by-quarter margins and so on and so forth. I will say that with everything we know, we see ESPN as a growth business, and we still believe that it will continue to grow. The specifics of how we get there, I don't want to get into, but I think that what Bob meant is that we see ESPN as a growth business, that he's confident of that. He was asked a question that happened to be about margins. I think what he was the news he was delivering was that ESPN's a growth business.
Okay. Let's switch over to another growth area, which is international. So can you talk a bit about driving growth internationally in cable networks? You may want to separate, you know, Disney from ESPN.
So. Yeah. Well, let me start with ESPN and kind of wrap up on that, because I think you've asked every question there is possible to ask about ESPN. Mm-hmm. But so, look, we all of you know that we have moved, out of the UK. We've unraveled our joint venture with Sky in Asia and Southeast Asia and India, and you know, it looks like a kind of a retraction of our international strategy for ESPN. I would say that it's a repositioning of our international strategy at ESPN. We continue to be very bullish about our growth prospects in Latin America. For ESPN, that business is doing great. Our Canadian business is doing well. Our business in Australia, New Zealand is doing well. And I wouldn't say that we are forever out of the sports business in either Asia or India. Just under the format we were in, you know, it was a situation with two partners that that started to see sort of a divergence in their interests in the region, and we decided, you know, to go our own way. So, look, I think that ESPN, on the large, in the intermediate term, is fundamentally a North American business as far as you guys are concerned. But we continue to push ESPN around the world wherever we think we can have a successful business model. That was not the case under the circumstance we were in the UK. Right. So we decided to pull out of that. But more importantly, in terms of the cable business, you know, the Disney Channel's international expansion is almost the exact opposite story. We are extremely bullish. We now have 106 Disney Channels in, I think, 147 countries. We are absolutely sure that the Disney Channel is the leading edge of bringing the Disney brand to most places around the world. The explosion of mobile access to consumers in markets where it took forever to get wired from a cable perspective, we think presents an incredible opportunity for our programming, and we will continue to push that as one of our key business strategies, either, you know, under the sort of traditional cable distribution system or free-to-air. And we've opened a lot of free-to-air channels, Russia, Turkey. We've moved to free-to-air in Spain, South Korea. We continue to realize that the Disney Channel is the bearer of our brand around the world. You know, of course, once we have a theme park in a region, that becomes a shared equity. Mm-hmm. But we know that's a great way for us to enter a lot of markets, and we continue to be bullish on it and like the business model that goes with it.
Okay. I've run out of ESPN questions for you. So I got to ask you about, you know, the real estate cost. But let me ask you about parks and resorts business that you know a lot about. We've now essentially completed all the major projects started under your watch as chairman way back when. Can you help us think about which projects are outperforming your initial plans? So we'll start with that.
Sure. Well, you know, we've been pretty vocal about Disney's California Adventure and the expansion there. And I don't know. There's so many measures against which you can try to so many metrics against which you can try to measure the success of something like that. And I it is, you know, an A plus on every single metric in terms of the quality of the product, the buzz it's created, the distribution of guests in that property, which was one of the underlying strategies. We had a very uneven distribution where most people spent most of their time at Disneyland, and Disney's California Adventure was empty, which was causing capacity issues at Disneyland and holding back our attendance. All solved. Now about half of the folks go to one, half of the folk go to the other. It's almost a dream come true. You've seen the trends quarter after quarter in terms of what it's done to the attendance there, how it's allowed us to price behind it. So that project has fulfilled, is on the trajectory of everything we'd hoped for it. Cruise Line, you know, now with the dream and the fantasy out there, full all the time, getting incredible premium rates, great guest ratings. Clearly that was a capacity need. That need's been met by the demand that we thought was out there, and we're very happy about it. And you know, so far, early days, but in the Magic Kingdom down in Florida, great reviews against what is the single most demanded event at a Disney park, which are character meet and greets. Many of those being princess character meet and greets. It is fulfilling a real need there. So if you look at those new projects, you know, in totality, you know, they are actually accretive in fiscal 13. The flip side is that that increase in OI is being offset by the investment we're still doing in My Magic Plus, which you know, will probably launch before the end of this year. And it's I won't say totality, but largely be launched by the end of this year and fiscal year. And you know, we have very high hopes for the early read is good, but right now it's still a drag on our earnings. In totality, we expect in 14 that all of those new initiatives will be accretive.
You also have a drag in earnings from startup costs at Shanghai. So there's a bit of a cost pressure.
But more in this towards the end of this fiscal year from My Magic Plus. Although Shanghai is definitely got expenses associated with that that investment underway.
I think I've made a living on keeping track of all the projects at the parks, and one of the questions we always get, and we'll ask you, is if you excluded all the new projects and initiatives, okay, do you expect to surpass the old peak margin in the years ahead?
That is a favorite question. So the nice thing about that question is the total lack of specificity about old and peak. But that's okay. I don't want to go back 100 years, you know, and back to the days where we weren't consolidating, you know, our foreign operations. We weren't pushing down incentive comp. Pension costs weren't where, you know, they are, and so on and so forth. So if we don't go back too far, and we go back like, I don't know, 10 years or, you know, 5 to 7 years, I'd say 10 years, if you back out a lot of stuff that's been going on that we were just talking about, we are basically at where we were in terms of the peak margins. And, you know, I've been saying when I was in my old job, and I've been saying on behalf of the new team, and Tom has been saying on his own, there is nothing to keep us structurally from achieving those margins in what was the base business. Now, at some point, the base business looks radically different. But I will tell you that as we see all of these new initiatives not only being accretive to OI, but accretive to margins, the new normal, we should wind up better than we are when those things are all, you know, running in their steady state. Yeah. So, but if you tear away today, like all of the stuff like that we didn't have in the first half of the 2000s, we're basically already there on the base business in terms of where the margins are. Now, I think we've still got, to be frank, a little way to go in terms of economic recovery. Not sure we're 100% back yet. So, we're bullish. We're bullish on the business. I mean, we're very, very happy with the way that business is evolving.
And given where consumer confidence is, it feels like the macro's going the right way.
Exactly.
Let me talk to you about Shanghai. It's now your biggest opportunity in front of you on the park side. Can you give us an update on the early developments going, and how should we think about the longer-term financial opportunity relative to Hong Kong or Euro? So,
to state it at 50,000 feet, we look at Shanghai, and the capacity is there, and the market is there in terms of land, available middle-class people, growth of the middle-class market, for Shanghai to be our second-largest theme park destination in the world. Yeah. Now, there's a long way between today and it surpassing, very successful businesses or aspects of our business in California and in Tokyo and Paris, etc. But if you look at the fundamentals and you look at the capacity in terms of the deal that we've done with the Chinese government in terms of access to land and infrastructure access for both people, utilities, etc. to that site, it certainly has the potential to be big. Vertical construction started a couple of months ago. All the infrastructure is well underway. We feel pretty good about the where we are creatively. We haven't made a whole lot of announcements way in advance about what the creative content will be. But, I think if you look at our history here and if you go way back and you look at Disneyland Paris, I think we over-anticipated, particularly in hotel capacity, what could be delivered on opening day to that park. One could argue at Hong Kong, the pendulum swung in the other direction. Right. We undersized it for expectations behind what a Disney park is. I think that in Shanghai, we're going to hit the nail on the head. We're going to be just where we want to be when we open with already an understanding between the partners and certainly internally at Disney that this could be a place that needs to ramp up very quickly in terms of capacity. And we feel very strongly that with our partners we've come to a great blend between things that is authentically Disney and everybody wants, no matter where in the world it is, they want something that they recognize as authentically Disney but distinct in the Chinese aspects of it. So, we kind of coined the phrase authentically Disney, distinctly Chinese, and I think that's going to take us a long way.
Yeah. And that's what we learned from Hong Kong, right? So in Hong Kong,
Over time, more and more sales of Hong Kong packages and visitation came from the mainland. So we've learned a lot about selling practices, about the structure of agents, the travel agent business, how to sell in mainland China, and that's going to give us a huge advantage for the opening of Shanghai. Even though we believe that it's fundamentally a separate market, it is still a mainland Chinese market, and we feel like we've gained a lot of experience since the opening of Hong Kong, which, by the way, its expansion has done remarkably well. We opened a couple of weeks ago the last phase of that three-land expansion that we did in Hong Kong, and the place is just on fire. It's just doing great. So I think that we're well prepared for Shanghai.
Okay, let me take you to studio for a bit. With the tremendous success of Avengers last year and now Iron Man 3, the $1.2 billion number, has the return profile now look on the Marvel deal? Because we sit here and we see the deal, but it's incredibly hard to measure it in the short cycle. You need to look at it.
Well, look, After we acquired Marvel, so going in, there was all this untapped IP. You heard it from us. It was written up broadly, 7,000-8,000 characters, really untapped. But just beneath that was also the sense that, you know, as a company the size that Marvel was at that time, they simply did not have access to the worldwide markets the way Disney does. And, you know, they were using reps around the world. You know, anybody who's in the licensing business knows you pay out 25% of your revenue to be repped by companies around the world. And we knew we could sweep all of that away virtually on day one and give that business over to Disney people that were already in the market to sell. We also knew that combining it with the sale of Disney licenses in regions around the world, that we were more powerful together as Disney and Marvel than Marvel could be on a freestanding basis. And that was sort of the early days, but we looked out and said, this isn't about taking a bunch of characters and trying to do better licensing deals. This is about using the entire Disney ecosystem, the machine that Disney has for distributing content around the world against what were largely nascent properties. You know, so Spider-Man was doing well already. Iron Man had the inkling that it could do well. But by and large, most of the Marvel characters and properties were pretty nascent. And we set our sights specifically on Avengers with a strategy that, you know, we'd release what's called an origin film for Thor, an origin film for Captain America, who would eventually show up in the Avengers. Of course, Iron Man was already out there. And then we'd end up introducing a few more characters, you know, into it. Hulk was already out there, that we would ultimately, you know, grow this thing. So when we released Avengers, we did put the power of the Walt Disney Company behind that. And I think, you know, for 2 years, we were incredibly patient and got asked lots of times the question you just asked me about, well, what's going on with Marvel and how's the integration going and so on and so forth. When we knew all along that we were setting ourselves up for this huge event that we believed would have, as I mentioned earlier, compounding effects on all the future films for those characters and be, in its own right, something that was sequelable and so on and so forth. So the plans turned out exactly as we'd hoped. We're firing on all cylinders. We've now got television production, both on the animation side, S.H.I.E.L.D., as I said. We're looking at theme park applications of Marvel. We use the IP in the digital space. It is just everything we'd hoped for that acquisition is happening. So we feel great about the returns there. It is the least of our worries. And we just hope and are starting to prepare for doing the same thing for Lucasfilm.
Well, I'll take it there. So that was a surprise, Lucasfilm acquisition. And you just mentioned all the Marvel things that you've been able to do. So like Marvel, do we need to wait and evaluate the returns of the box office, or things you can do right now that can drive returns on Lucasfilm?
Well, look, clearly we are, as a company, you know, very focused on 2015 and the release of the next first film of the next Star Wars trilogy. But we're not sitting back, you know, on our laurels waiting for everything to happen. So if I kind of tick through, and maybe some of this will be a little bit vague, but if I tick through what is going on, so Lucas had the same situation with reps around the world outside of the U.S., and we've already sort of issued notice that we'll take that in-house. We have already started to strategize and, in fact, taken out into the field with some pretty important licensing deals to us, sort of the combined force of Star Wars, Marvel, and Disney, and sort of presented that as a single unified idea and shared the best ofs across the different ways of thinking about our contracts. We've announced that we've got that first film in 2015, and at the time of acquisition said we would come back with a Star Wars film every 2 years, but subsequently have announced that we will do sort of origin stories or, you know, stories within the story of the Star Wars worlds the years in between. So now we'll be coming out with a film, you know, every year that will be wrapped up in the Star Wars mythology. We've also launched Star Wars Rebels as an animated television concept, and we continue to really push the envelope on what can happen while we're working on this, what will be a highly anticipated film release in 2015. So lots of stuff is happening, a little below the surface. By the way, lots of stuff was happening on the Marvel acquisition before the release of Avengers as well. But, you know, we clearly know that, you know, this will be a big event for us, and we'll be fully prepared to take advantage of it.
Let me ask you, is there a philosophical question here? Disney's moved away with Marvel, Pixar, Lucas, from building its own viable IP to becoming a portfolio company that you could successfully monetize other people's IP. Is that a statement about the ease or the challenge in building franchises going forward?
No, I don't think so. If you have to say that, you know, with Tangled and Wreck-It Ralph, Disney Animation is really back hitting on cylinders. Those were two amazingly successful franchises, the first of which, Tangled, has already largely worked its way through the ecosystem. Wreck-It Ralph just beginning to work its way through the ecosystem. And if you look at the Disney Channel, you know, Disney Channel now number one among kids programming. Franchises like Doc McStuffin and Jake and the Neverland Pirates. I mean, these are incredibly powerful, classical Disney franchises that, you know, as you said, you and I are old, and we don't have 3- and 5-year-olds running around our house.
I'm a 2-year-old.
3- and 5-year-olds. But if you did have a 3- and 5-year-old running around your house, you'd know all about Doc McStuffin and Jake and the Neverland Pirates. So I don't want to say that even though, you know, Marvel has a concept so huge, Star Wars is a concept so huge, you know, casts a very big shadow, it doesn't mean that we are out of the IP creation business. It is, you know, IP creation is the DNA of Disney. There is an incredible expectation behind the Disney brand for what that means, and it's not the same as Marvel, and it's not the same as Star Wars. And we continue to feed that pipeline. We've got Monsters University coming out very soon. I think you're going to see that, you know, Pixar has kind of slid into what people think of as Disney. It's been part of the company long enough to be that. And then we've got Frozen coming out, our next animated release. And, I think that the IP that we're creating within the company has just as much impact on some of the franchises we haven't talked about, you know, like Princess, Cars, Toy Story, as those things that we acquired.
Okay. Let me take you through some questions here. One on retrans, a hot topic, broadcast network. How quickly should we expect the ramp in retrans to $1 billion after you hit your target, which you stated of $400 to $500 million? So what is the next level look like?
We've got, I'm not going to give any predictions about that. We've got, we put our $450 to $500 million number out there by 2015. We've got long-term deals that obviously have escalation as part of them, but I'm not going to get into the details about the trajectory.
Well, how about this? From the moment when you put that restriction out, are the fees getting better than what you first imagined?
Consistent with what we put out.
Okay. SVOD, non-authenticated. Can you share your thinking on selling SVOD, your first pay window for films, plus ABC.com and Hulu strategy, with non-authentic access, given how important affiliate fees are? So the strategy of allowing some of your better content to go to places that are non-authenticated.
Look, as a content creator, from a pure economics basis or a pure economist perspective, you'd love to have more people out there looking for your content. And, the success of your business strategy is how nimble you can be in making the right decisions, both from a short-term economic perspective and long-term structural perspective, in the exploitation of your IP. I've reviewed many, many times with all of you the principles under which we like to think about non-authenticated use of our IP. Obviously, we're huge beneficiaries of the authenticated ecosystem, and we continue to value it and want to continue to strengthen it, and I think we do that in every deal that we do, and the bells and whistles that come with the multi-platform strategy we're using. But let's face it, you know, there are big dollars out there to be had for those who are finding, you know, a sort of opportunity in the non-authenticated world to provide a service that clearly is being demanded. And as a content provider, we want to take advantage of that and have been. So I don't want to be too predictive about what our next deal will be, but we talk to lots of people, and I think as our job is to continue to create content that, you know, five people show up and want to do a deal to use, including our authenticated world partners.
Okay. A couple on parks. One is, do you have increased confidence looking at parks that the U.S. consumer is getting healthier based on any kind of things you're seeing at the park level?
Look, we kind of give you, I mean, you get of course our reported numbers, but we, you know, try to give you trends, looking out at every quarter at what we're seeing. We've seen, you know, I guess by way of the fact that we're a couple of weeks down the road, I am updating what we said on our Q3 numbers, but we're seeing the same trends across the board that we saw when we announced our Q2 results in terms of our bookings pacing, our, you know, per capita spending, and so on and so forth. So I'd have to say that for every quarter that you continue to see you know, improved results in that business, you have to say that the consumer is getting healthier. What I say, stepping back from the observations of our own business, that there's something indicating that, you know, all the clouds have separated and the world, you know, is a sunny place. I don't think so. I don't think we have enough information to know that.
Okay. A couple on capital returns. One, in light of many of your companies in your peer group taking steps to get smaller through asset sales and spinoffs, can you help us think about how Disney views the need to be in all the businesses that you're in now?
Look, I think that when we step back and we look at our businesses, we think that, you know, each and every one supports the notion that we started with, you know, an hour ago about the Disney difference and what gives us the opportunity to distribute great content to just about every way it can be consumed. And some of those are through great partnerships, and some of those are direct. You know, like theme parks and the network, and I would say that we don't have any holes in our asset in our ecosystem that I feel like we need to go out and buy something to fill it, and nor on the flip side are we desperate to get rid of something because it's just a terrible fit. Now, are there things that are more consistent with the Disney ecosystem than other things? Yes, there are some things that are more consistent. But we feel like living up to, you know, fundamentally what we are, a family entertainment company, a content creator, we're pretty happy with the mix of assets we have today.
Okay, one question on RFID. Okay, so the question is...
Sounds technical.
Any additional details you can share, both financial or technical, or update timing of rollout for the project? So what point do we start seeing it?
Yeah, well, we've done a lot of pilots down there. If you've been down in Walt Disney World over the last 2 or 3 months, you may well have been walking around wearing a wristband. We've done all the hotel room keys have been converted to our RFID. And, you know, I think that the team just... wants to live up to our reputation of being perfect when they launch this thing. It's a big undertaking. I think it has amazing, amazing value to consumers, whether it's in the pre-planning, whether it's carrying those plans around with you, whether it's having the access to your planned itinerary via, you know, advanced fast passes, being able to make transactions in a seamless, quick, easy way, being able to be exposed to opportunities because we know where you are and when you show up at places, if you so desire to opt in, I think opens up a world of opportunity both for consumers' enjoyment of our property and our ability to retain loyal customers, increase the frequency of their visits, perhaps bring some people in who have been turned away by frankly, turned away by our success, the number of people who are down at Walt Disney World or Disneyland on any given day, as well as upselling opportunities. So I think it's a huge win for consumers. I think it's a big win for us. As I said, I think by the end of this fiscal year, you're going to feel like it's rolled out, but there are aspects of it that will continue to be enhanced over time.
Feel like both from the cost side, but also the revenue opportunity.
Possibly. Yeah. Okay. I think the revenue opportunities, and remember that what we said on our last earnings call in some detail was that a lot of the revenue opportunity is literally increasing the volume of people and the amount of time that they spend with us. There will be other bells and whistles that tier into that, and maybe not all those will be available by the end of this fiscal year, but will be over time.
Okay, last question, and you'll laugh because it's about sports and ESPN, is given the increasing value of sports rights, why not buy more teams in local markets and maybe get into local market business in terms of the local RSN business versus the national business?
We've done a lot of, obviously, a lot of chatter about RSNs and, the incredible numbers that have been, attributed and associated with their services. We've really had the chance to think strategically about what we are and what they are. And we like to believe at ESPN that we are a network for sports fans. RSNs are generally a network for, call it whatever, Dodger fans, Yankee fans. And we like our positioning as being the sort of number one brand in sports for sports fans. And if I'm interested in sports, I'm going to turn on ESPN. As opposed to if I'm interested in the Chicago Cubs, I'm going to turn on, XYZ. So I don't see us moving into that business. I think we're happy with the definition of the business as we see it. We're good at it. And fans and advertisers and our MVPD partners tell us that every year. 13 consecutive years, we've been the number one valued network. I feel like we know the business we're in. We'll stick to it.
Okay. And with that, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lowell. Thank you so much.